Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 159, being recorded on the 21st of December, 2016, with special guest Saad Latke. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me I have Kale, Evan, and of course our special guest Saad. And as usual, before we get talking to Saad about a very interesting topic on Azure resiliency, let's just do a quick rundown of some new updates in the Azure space. And just also a quick note over here that this episode that we're recording, it was actually the second episode of the for us for the day, but it'll actually get broadcasted out next week. That is on the 28th of December. That's when it'll actually hit the servers, but we're recording it today just because next week is the holiday week. So yes, Kale, you said you saw something that just hit the wire on your favorite topic. Go ahead. What is that?
Of course, blockchain. So Project Bletchley, Corda. So probably people have heard of R3 that are plugged into the either financial markets or blockchain. R3 is a pretty big consortium of banks. So it's a fintech opportunity. And we've been working with them to integrate their Corda solution into Azure. So that just went live, and there's a blog post up there about it, talking about some of the use cases for it, as well as how to get started with it. Obviously, one-click installs, and there's tons of documentation and white papers about the models that they use.
Wow, very nice. And is that release already? Is that what you said, or are they? What's the?
Yeah, just went live.
Just went live. Okay, yep. Excellent. Hot off the press. Great. And I know you put some other updates in there. I'll go with one. This is DocumentDB one that I saw. It now supports change feed support, which is kind of interesting. I guess that's some sort of notification that you can get when maybe a document is inserted into the database or something is changed, right? And you want to be triggered when something like that happens, like a notification. So they have this concept of a change feed, which I think has a number of use cases. If you need to do some processing or like stream, you know, if you're getting a stream of data and you need to be processing that data as soon as it hits the wire, as soon as it hits your database, that's one way to do it. Or if you need to maybe drop a copy of this data to, say, a backup database, or maybe in another cloud vendor, and then you could use that to synchronize the data, you know. So that's, I thought that was an interesting update.
I was looking at that feature. And, you know, it struck me looking at these, we're seeing a lot of this with a lot of the different services where they're layering some of the things you would write code to periodically, you know, poll your data source or poll your service to see if there's a change. We're adding kind of base features to do that, right, in a lot of different places, which is nice because now you can kind of tie all these different things together. You can kind of see where logic gaps and functions and this type of stuff
with the whole
all
web
play
hooks.
Nicely together.
Right, with the, with the whole webhooks phenomenon, right, and it's basically, you know, polling's a bad thing, right? I think we all know that. You know, you just sit and chew up CPU cycles. So I like these notification systems. They're good.
Yeah, agreed.
What, anything that you like in there, Evan, in the list?
I got, you know, just like Kale's got to talk about blockchain, I got to talk about SQL. So, there's some new features and functionality for Azure SQL Data Warehouse, right? This is the massively parallel. Even though SQL Azure, you know, can go pretty parallel by itself, but this is kind of another level of parallelism on top of it. There's some new integration with Azure Data Factory, right, which we talked about a number of shows back. And then again, this is, you know, trying to put me out of business here, but we're doing this in a lot of services. We're, as you go in and looking at your resource and you go into the portal and say, hey, I'm having a problem with this resource I want to figure out. What we're trying to do is present common problems and common solutions, right? And this ties into the resource health checks that we do, so that, you know, we can detect maybe what's wrong and tell you what's wrong so you can resolve it, or at least kind of throw up to you, hey, we know you're on this type of resource. These are the common problems. Here's how you solve those without you having to go, you know, search the web for that information, right? We want to kind of put it right in front of you when you go.
Good. Very good. Kale, is there one that you like, or I could go?
Yeah. One other one we had here was around logic apps. So people are familiar with that. It's more of the like serverless type situation where we have a service up there that you can essentially plug together components and orchestrate different business logic or different kind of operations up there that run in kind of a workflow type fashion. And they have this, I wasn't aware of this, but they have this enterprise integration pack, and I guess it's GA now, which basically does a bunch more enhanced things. Because like, if you go look at logic apps, you'll see a lot of the social networks and, you know, raw storage and things like that. So you can hook up, you know, things and orchestrate things such that if somebody tweets about a certain thing, you can actually orchestrate and maybe save it to a database or do other things. But these are more like hardcore business focused on like EDI and B2B transactions. So really things that are pertinent to the enterprise, and being able to leverage this serverless technology like Azure Functions and logic apps to do these things for you. So there is like almost zero footprint other than, you know, obviously storage and things.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I was looking at this, you know, what jumped to my mind was Bistalk services, right?
Yeah.
Traditionally, it's been done by Bistalk, all this enterprise connectivity. But Bistalk can be quite, I guess, difficult to set up and difficult to understand sometimes. And I think they're doing a good thing by taking some of that functionality and moving it to logic apps, because that's a lot easier to use. And now you can make that connect into all these enterprise systems much more easily.
And much cheaper.
Yeah,
running that infrastructure. It's got to be.
Yep.
I think BizTalk is still going to be there for, you know, really custom or really kind of unusual solutions. But you can certainly see these types of things taking place of that stuff.
Yep. Excellent. Good set of updates. Okay, well, I guess let's just turn our attention over to our special guest, Saad. And Saad, I would appreciate if you could introduce yourself for our listeners and give us some background about what you do at Microsoft and what your passion is all about in the cloud space.
Sure thing, Sujeet. First of all, thank you for having me on here today. So my name is Saad Latki, and I'm a PM manager in Azure. My primary focus is around what we call Azure resiliency, and that's the topic that we're going to be covering here. In terms of my background, I've worked at Microsoft and at AWS, mostly in the cloud space over the last few years. My experience is generally focused on building web services and how we basically make sure that these web services serve customers from the perspective of helping them build resilient applications, scalable applications, secure applications, et cetera, on the cloud.
That's great. Yeah, you know, when I first heard about, you know, the word Azure and resiliency used in the same sentence, I was a little like taken aback, because I always assumed that Azure was always resilient. That's one of the reasons why people moved to the cloud. So why do we have to take a special care about resiliency, you know, given that people expect the cloud to be resilient in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sujeet. And let me take a step back and just, first of all, you know, introduce what the term resiliency means and why we even use it. So when we think about resiliency, it's really the ability for an app or a service to recover from failure or from different types of disasters or faults that might happen in the day-to-day life of running that application. And we want that application to be able to continue to function despite, you know, any kind of fault or issue that might arise. We're not talking about, you know, here about avoiding failures or completely eliminating them, because that's somewhat unrealistic. We all know in the world out there that you know, as applications run, and if you've managed data centers or if you've managed any type of hardware, at some point something is bound to go wrong, and we want to make sure that our customers understand, you know, the way that different, you know, components fail and how to build applications that ultimately really survive, you know, these types of failures and never see them. So my job is frankly twofold here. I spend a lot of time, you know, looking internally at all of the different, you know, teams and at all of the different services that we have, and making sure that they're as resilient as they can possibly be in terms of all the failures that we can, you know, imagine. Now, at the same time, resiliency is a bit of a shared responsibility, because every application out there has different requirements on what it means to be resilient. So I'm happy to talk a little bit more about, you know, how you know, we think about that spectrum, I guess, in terms of where the platform, you know, does things on behalf of the customer and where the customer has to apply a little bit of design thinking and mechanisms that we give them in order to build resilient applications.
Yeah, that would be great. Just yeah. Because, I mean, I'm in support, and I can't tell you how many times I've had customers call us and say, "Hey, I moved my app and it went down."
Yeah.
Right. Well, isn't Azure, you know, resilient? Well, yeah, but sort of. Yes. No. So yeah. I mean, it sounds like you're definitely playing right in that space. Love to hear kind of how you present that to those to folks like that.
No, absolutely. So let me start, you know, with how we look at resiliency. So I think, you know, when we think about the cloud, there's always two aspects to the cloud. There's obviously the infrastructure and the data centers and the hardware that's basically running the cloud. And then there's the software. And of course, we don't want customers, you know, thinking about what's happening in the data center and all of the, you know, small details of us, you know, managing and operating the infrastructure up to the software promise that we make. And so if we take an example, let's talk about, you know, VMs. So when we look at, you know, VMs, a single VM that's built on Azure today comes with a promise or an SLA of three nines, and that effectively says that, you know, the customer should not really think about how we basically manage, you know, drive failures or, you know, memory failures or anything, you know, in terms of hardware that's within the data center and the software that's basically managing that VM, as long as we deliver, you know, that SLA back to the customer. Now, but of course, you know, that SLA also implies that there is potential for, you know, that things might go wrong. And if the application that's basically using this VM ultimately cannot tolerate this, you know, downtime, then the customer needs to be doing something different. And so part one of what the platform does is we basically handle all of the minutia of managing, you know, the infrastructure and the data centers and the operations and the day-to-day of all of that, so that, you know, we can deliver some of these promises back to the customer. Step two in this spectrum is, we need to basically, you know, provide mechanisms for the customer to build resilient applications. So continuing with this, you know, VM analogy, let's say, you know, the customer now decides that, okay, the requirements for their app requires that it's more available, requires the app to be more available and more resilient than the, so now what the customer has to do is to use a different, you know, mechanism that we offer, and we call these availability sets. And availability sets are basically a mechanism that allows us to manage the resiliency of VMs as long as the customer is running more than one VM at a time. And so if the customer is running multiple VMs in an availability set, then that SLA or that promise that we're making and the extra, you know, effort that we put into the software and the hardware in terms of maintaining those VMs goes up. And the promise now is basically 3.5 nines. So as I said, you know, like the spectrum, I started, you know, by talking about, you know, us managing the infrastructure and the base platform, and then two, giving customers, you know, mechanisms to help them build those resilient applications. I think step three that I want to talk about today is we need to give basically customers design guidance. And this is partly maybe what you see in support, Evan, in terms of customers, you know, coming to us and saying, "Oh, I did not really expect this." And I think, you know, that there's some design consideration that we want customers to apply to their application. And one quick thing that I'm going to point out here is azure.com/resiliency is probably everybody's best friend on this topic. So we've basically, you know, put a lot of effort to, in terms of building a bunch of content that talks about resiliency, and we focused it on how you build resilient applications on Azure, as well as specific guidance on a per service basis. So that way, you know, customers can basically absorb, you know, some of the high level, you know, thinking that we have, but at the same time also build, you know, very resilient applications depending on the service that they're using. Now, that's, you know, capability three. Capability four is ultimately, you know, some customers, you know, are happy to just, you know, say, okay, I want to pay a premium for higher availability, and you guys take care of, you know, whatever happens there. And so one of the things that you also look at is how can we design software in such a way that it handles internally, you know, a lot of the resiliency for customers. So if you look at something like storage, for example, storage has an option called geo-redundant storage, which automatically replicates customers' data across two regions without the customer having to do any additional work. As a matter of fact, if you look at a customer application written to use the single region, you know, type of storage that we call locally redundant storage versus using the geo-redundant storage option, really there isn't any difference. So it's transparent to the application. And the reason why that's important is because for customers who want to tolerate, or for the applications that want to tolerate even more types of faults and failures, let's imagine, you know, the very, very rare, you know, types of disasters that might hit a region. Now, if the application needs to tolerate that, then by leveraging something like, you know, GRS, the data will automatically, you know, be replicated to a different region and available in case, you know, one of the Azure region fail. So that's extra guarantee that we basically, you know, provide customers through platform functionality. That allows them to basically build even more resilient applications. So that's really the spectrum. And I think, you know, the customer responsibility ultimately lies on how to basically connect the dots between these different components and leverage the level of resiliency that's most suitable for their application. Now, every application is going to have a different requirement. As I've hinted at before, when I talked about, you know, some maybe marketing type of, you know, app versus mission critical, you know, system for companies. The question that customers need to be asking when thinking about how to design for resiliency is how much downtime is acceptable, and what type of what type of faults and disasters should the app, you know, be able to tolerate? And that's going to be a function also of cost, and what does it cost their business? So if you can imagine, if having, you know, 1 minute of downtime causes the business, you know, to lose, let's say, you know, millions of dollars, then maybe incurring a cost of an additional, you know, few hundred dollars to basically run, you know, a couple of VMs as opposed to a single VM type of application, then that's probably a very worthwhile, you know, ROI for the business. And that's really the way that we encourage, you know, customers to think about resiliency in general. And that's also, you know, baked into part of the guidance that we have online.
Do you, when you talk through these, right, you can certainly see a number of different pivots, right? You could look at, you know, hey, I'm going to kind of rely on Azure's general redundancy, mm-hmm. right, and resiliency, and then I'm going to rely on some, you know, some level of geographic, you know, resiliency. But then also you can see some scenarios where you could say, okay, well, I'm going to build my environment, so I do have multiple VMs in my, you know, availability set. I've maybe got scale sets, but I'm going to do some of my VMs smaller, so that mm-hmm. I can still be up, but in a reduced capacity. Does that come into the conversation for you as well when you talk about resiliency, or do you generally not go to that kind of level of detail in some of these conversations?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if your application can run on a smaller size of VM, for example, but maybe with a degraded experience, that might be actually acceptable for some applications. Like for many applications out there, when customers think about resiliency for these applications, they're not necessarily thinking that the app needs to basically maintain 100% of its experience, right? Some applications and some, you know, customer scenarios often involve, you know, a degradation in the app's experience if there was ever, you know, some kind of major disaster, right? And as you said, if switching to a smaller VM size ensures that there's a smooth transition if a fault, you know, was to happen in region one to a different region, to region two, then maybe that's an acceptable, you know, trade-off for that application. So that's definitely, you know, another pivot of looking at this.
I think yeah, the other thing,
go ahead, Cal.
No, I was thinking we just had a talk in the last podcast about you know, migrations and applications that maybe are not 100% built for the cloud. Mm-hmm. And so considerations as they're migrating to the cloud to make sure that they're going to be resilient and whatnot. And some of the things I've seen is, you know, you think about not just what's the maximum time they can be down, but one of the things that I've personally run into is some of these databases and some of these really large systems take a while to come back. Mm-hmm. Like even if we can get the server running back up again, it takes time for that application or for the indexes to be rebuilt and all these kind of things. So, mm-hmm. you know, in those cases, it's like, do we make app changes and try to make those smaller so that we can make that RPO a little bit smaller and then we can make this thing more resilient and whatnot?
Mm-hmm. No, that's an awesome question, Kale. I think let me tackle two different things that you've talked about. So first, let me tackle, you know, some of the existing, you know, on-prem applications that are moving to the cloud and how should they think about resiliency. And then let's tackle, you know, like the second part of the question, which is, you know, like how do we make sure that you know, things actually continue to work, even, you know, when we think that they might be designed to work in the face of a disaster, right? So on the first part, I think, you know, apps that are designed today, you know, and that are running maybe on-prem, I think I'm going to do a very big generalization here, but let's classify them into two buckets. Applications that care about resiliency, and those are generally, you know, deployed in what's known as a Metro DR type of configuration. And then applications that don't necessarily care about resiliency as much, and this is the equivalent of kind of like saying, okay, I'm running a single VM, right? Now, the applications that do care about resiliency and that are running in a Metro DR, you know, type of setup, that typically implies that the, you know, the customer has basically went through the trouble of configuring two different sets of hardware and two different maybe data centers. Sometimes they're actually across the street from each other, frankly. That's what I've seen very often. But for the customers who are looking for a higher level of resiliency, then they tend to put them, you know, further away, maybe within the same boundary of the same city. And what that gives them is it basically gives them, you know, some isolation. It gives them, you know, probably different, you know, power sources, probably different, you know, cooling sources, probably different networks that are interconnecting, you know, that hardware and the equipment. But ultimately, they're probably still relying on the same software that's running on top of it, which gets me to the second point, which is, you know, once that software is written and you assume that it's actually, you know, resilient to any type of disaster, one of the biggest things that we see that we're also trying, you know, to help customers with is all of the resiliency work that you do is frankly a use it or lose it type of work. So very often I've heard customers say, well, I've designed, you know, my application to be regionally redundant or geo redundant, and, you know, if disaster were to hit today, I'm going to fail over, right? And then sure enough, something happens and they try to fail over, and then the failover mechanism doesn't work as expected, because as you said, maybe a database, you know, takes too long to boot up, or maybe because there was some state that the application, you know, expected to have when it was booting up that it didn't have, and so it booted up into a different state, and, you know, things did not work as expected, right? And so we tend to basically encourage customers to test the capabilities, and as a matter of fact, we even do it internally. So one of the things that we do for the platform is what we call disaster recovery drills. So as you know, we have, as of today, I believe we have 38 Azure regions globally, and those come typically in what we call geo pairs. So every time that we bring up a new geography, it comes typically with two regions that are paired together. And the reason why we do that is because we want to make sure that customers can build applications that support disaster recovery mechanisms that we have across those two regions. And at the same time, we want customers to be able to maintain their data within the data residency boundaries of the same geography, right? So when we do that, we're able to go and run drills. And, you know, customers who want to participate in those drills, you know, get to participate in those drills, you know, with us early enough, you know, in the launch of a region, where we basically go and, like, literally, like, shut down a data center and then reboot it and then, you know, see what happens. And that's, I know that's a massive, you know, effort, and we can only do that, you know, before the region is actually live. But that's super helpful because it helps us, you know, identify issues that we may have not foreseen, as well as customers, you know, can I also identify issues, you know, with their own, you know, failover strategies that they might have built on top of our services. So what I'm saying here is, like, I think, you know, there's a path that's easy, you know, to move applications from on-prem today to the cloud with minor maybe modifications. I don't think, you know, we need to modify them very much. But irrespective of whether you're on the cloud or not, I think, you know, unless you test and you validate, you know, how things are running and how things are working, you cannot really guarantee that when disaster happens, that your mechanism is really going to work.
I would have to second that. I mean, I have been on many, 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 many server down cases where somebody did a failover, you know, either, you know, testing or, you know, in a real world scenario, like when, you know, the flooding in New Orleans or, you know, Superstorm Sandy in New Jersey, we had a ton of calls from customers, and lots of people's failovers didn't work. Because they had never tested it, right? Or they'd done some small testing, but they really hadn't, you know, tested the functionality. It's really, I think that's probably the one thing that I would stress coming from my perspective of the world. Yeah, if you don't test this, just pretend it's not going to work.
Yeah, and
you really have no idea.
And look, Evan, I mean, like, even if you're not going to do, you know, a massive drill as the one that I just described, which, frankly, like, if you're running on-prem, a lot of customers are not going to be able to afford to do because they might not have the two data centers, or the two data centers that they might have might be shared with other customers, right? But even then, like, I think, you know, the other couple, you know, pieces of advice here is, if you can drill. If you can't, you know, there's plenty of tools that can help, you know, out there in terms of, like, you know, generating faults and chaos into your system. And those are, I think, you know, another super helpful mechanism to validate resiliency. And then third, and that's one we also actually use. So Azure, we've actually gone through a certification process called ISO 22301. Which is really a certification that attests to how we basically, you know, conduct our business and what are, you know, our business continuity processes that we have. And it really, like, that shows that we demonstrate rigor in the practices that allow us to prevent and to mitigate and to respond and recover from you know, fairly big incidents, right? That's basically the key of it. And a lot of these guidelines guidance that you can get, you know, out of the 22301 is public information. So you can even go and, like, you know, on a piece of paper, do a bunch of these exercises, and it's going to be surprising, you know, the level of details that you're going to go into as you're analyzing on paper, you know, your software, and what you might find and be able to resolve, even if you cannot, you know, go and do a massive, you know, type of drill. So just like, you know, we do it internally as part of, you know, running the cloud, and we have, you know, some significant amount of scale, you know, behind it. So being able to do something like that is actually a significant undertaking. But I think, you know, customers can probably do it even at a smaller scale, you know, on their applications that might be running on the cloud as well.
Yeah, no, great point.
That's very good. Very well put, Saad. Thank you. I think that kind of lays out the various phases that a customer has to go through, right, to kind of achieve this level of resiliency that they're comfortable with, both from a failure perspective as well as from a cost perspective. And I think that's really the whole thing, right? How much money do you want to spend to get to that point where, you know, you're not losing that much of business, right? Mm-hmm. Your business costs are not as high as you expect them to be in case of a failure. So I think that's well put, that, you know, so using some basic things in Azure, like the geo-redundancy storage, for example, we can achieve that level of resiliency.
Yeah, the other thing I would throw in there too, Sajid, and this is just kind of I have this conversation with customers a lot, is make sure that you rethink, and Saad touched on some of this stuff, but make sure you rethink your DR plans for and your resiliency plans for capabilities in the cloud. Just, you know, one real simple example, standard VMs versus premium VMs, right? You know, when they're using standard storage or premium, they come with totally different SLAs. There is no single instance SLA for VMs on standard storage. On premium storage, there's actually a single instance SLA. So
there's a lot of work that it seems like Azure's doing to help customers from an automated fashion. So obviously the documentation that you mentioned at the link is very good, and customers should review that. But from a point of saying, like I remember even way earlier on, this might have even been in the old portal, when you would spin up VMs, if it was a single instance, it would warn you that you're basically not getting an SLA because of what you did. Taking that a step further, like some of this Azure Advisor and some of the tools that's built into Azure now, I mean, is that places where you see that going to expand to kind of guide people, hey, you might be doing the wrong thing here, or if you want more uptime, do this, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I think, you know, in terms of these automated, you know, mechanisms and notifications and design guidance, totally, you know, there's plenty of opportunities, you know, for us to do even more. I think the one thing that we tend to tiptoe around, you know, very often, and this is just maybe a little bit of an interesting discussion is, like for some customers, I think, you know, like warning them about some of these things might be a little bit too scary, despite the fact that maybe the stance of their app with the current, you know, like with whatever they have chosen might be the right, you know, choice for them. So we often, you know, have to find the right amount of balance between, you know, warning customers and giving, you know, guidance versus, you know, being too cautious and maybe, you know, scaring folks into you know, doing unnatural things for their type of application. But I completely agree with you, and I think, you know, ultimately, like, we'll probably see more of these more of this automated guidance out there, and that's probably going to go hand in hand with a better understanding of what the customer design points are. So I think, you know, what you see today is probably going to continue evolving to be more of a conversational type of interface where customers should be able to express to that automation, you know, what they're trying to achieve, and then get very specific guidance based off of, you know, the requirements that they have for their application.
Nice. That's awesome.
Right. Thanks a lot, Saad. This has been some great information that you've shared with our listeners. And I really appreciate that link that you sent us. We'll put it in the show notes. And if there's any other links or resources that you wish to share, please send that us our way, and we'll put it along with the podcast episode.
Yeah, I will. And I'll make sure to include the 3.9's single SLA link as well, just to hold me accountable. But yes, no, I'll definitely do that. And thank you for having me. This was a very good conversation. And, you know, if there's, you know, more topics that you guys want to drill into, I know we've covered, you know, the broad spectrum here, but happy to do that in the future as well.
Thank you. I might take care of that.
Thanks,
Ed. All right, yeah, so, thank you guys.
Thank
Happy
you.
Holidays.
Thanks.
Bye. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, Evan, you want to say something about Crystal reports?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, when we were talking earlier, you know, I made a comment about Crystal being dead, and I did some digging, and actually I was incorrect. So there is a version of Crystal that shipped with Visual Studio, I don't know, 2003 or, you know, really early version of Visual Studio. That version doesn't have a life cycle, but there is actually, it looks like it's moved from business objects to, I think it lived with Oracle for a while, but now it's with SAP. So there is a full, you know, Crystal Report server. You know, you can integrate with Visual Studio, you know, put it in your app. So I apologize, Crystal Reports. You're not dead. You're very much alive and apparently a well liked product. So audience, please don't throw things at me.
Thank you for that clarity. And hey, you guys have a good holiday, all the listeners
too. You too.
And
you as well.
We'll see you in the new year.
Sounds good. Bye guys.
Thanks guys.
Okay.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.